सहितं कृष्ण चैतन्य देवं श्री राधा कृष्ण पादान सहगण ललिता श्री विशाखान्वितांश्च नमा ओम विष्णुपादाय कृष्ण प्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्ति वेदांत स्वामीति नामिने नमस्ते सारस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी आजात्य देश तारिणे नमो महावदन्याय कृष्ण प्रेम प्रदायते कृष्णाय कृष्ण चैतन्य नामने गौरत्विषे नमः। हे कृष्णा करुणा सिंधो दीनबंधो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिका कांत राधा कांत नमोस्तुते तप्त कांचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरि प्रिय वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभो नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्णा कृष्णा हरे राम 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 हरे हरे
हरे कृष्णा। आई वेलकम ऑल ऑफ यू टू दिस संडे प्रोग्राम। टुडे वी विल बी डिस्कसिंग अबाउट द ग्लोरीज ऑफ लॉर्ड कृष्णा एज अ प्रिपेरेशन ऑफ आवर कॉन्शियसनेस फॉर जन्माष्टमी व्हिच इज जस्ट अ फ्यू डेज अवे। आई विल टॉक अबाउट द ऑपुलेंसेस ऑफ कृष्णा बेस्ड ऑन अ एक्रोनिम KRISHNA एंड विल डिस्कस नॉट जस्ट द opulences of Krishna, but a distinctive feature of Krishna that he not only has opulences, but he shares his opulences with his devotees. Kulashekhar Maharaj is a great devotee of Lord Krishna, and he has written a celebrated set of prayers called Mukundamala Stotra. And therein he says, a characteristic of the Supreme Lord is that Svasya Padasya Datari Pare Narayane Tishtati. He says that this Lord, he shares his abode and shares his opulence with those who serve him, with his devotees. Pare Narayane Tishtati. That is the nature of the absolute truth. That Lord not only has opulences, but the Lord shares his opulences. And often, within his pastimes, he arranges that his devotees sometimes manifest these opulences more than him also. So, the Sanskrit word for opulence is Aishwarya. The word Bhagavan is actually explained in various ways by different acharyas. But Vana means possessor. Bhaga is the opulence. So, Bhagavan is one who is the possessor of opulences. And actually, the scriptures tell us that one who knows Bhagavan becomes Bhagyavan. That one who knows the Supreme Lord in truth, such a person becomes attracted to the Lord, develops love for the Lord, and that is the supreme good fortune. So what does it mean to know Krishna? Now, many people can say, yes, I have heard of Krishna from my childhood. And there are so many TV channels, so many comics are there, Amar Chitra Katha is there, so many games are there. There is a little Krishna video we have seen. We all know Krishna. Actually, yes, that is knowing Krishna at one level. But now real knowledge of Krishna is not just theoretical. It is transformational. What is the transformation that knowledge about Krishna brings about? That transformation is the redirection of our heart's love from the things of this world to Krishna. And that happens when we understand Krishna in truth. Tattvataha. In 4.9, Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita, Janma karma chame divyam evam yoveti tattvataha tiktva deham punar janma naiti mameti sarjuna. So he says that those who come to know about me, they will not take birth again in this world, but they will return back to me. Mameti. But for this to happen, Krishna says tattvataha. We have to understand him in truth. So, one way of understanding Krishna in truth is to understand his opulences and to understand how he uses these opulences in his pastimes. So, in this world, we are attracted to people who are wealthy, people who are powerful, people who are good-looking. Like that, there are, the scriptures describe, six primary opulences. So, there is wealth, beauty, strength, wisdom, renunciation, and fame. Now, generally speaking, most people will say this. I want to be wise. I want to be famous. I want to be knowledgeable. I want to be wealthy. But renunciation is not considered to be a particularly attractive opulence. How many people really want to be renounced? Most people don't. Then why is renunciation considered to be an opulence? People may not want renunciation, but people want the fruit of renunciation. What is the fruit of renunciation? Peace. Krishna says, Tyaga Chantir Anantaram. Tyaga, if there is Tyaga, then the result of Tyaga is Shanti. In 12.12 he describes that from detachment, from renunciation comes peace. So, if somebody can be very peaceful, very steady, then that person is admired. Now, if there is some high pressure cricket match going on and the last final overs, final delivery, somebody says very cool and plays, then that person becomes a source of admiration for everyone. And the person who loses his cool, that person is denigrated as a choker. So what happens is that peace is opulence that attracts people. Peace in terms of being unflappable. Now many people may want peace externally, but peace externally is possible in a sustainable way when there are no desires rioting within us internally. If desires are on a riot internally, then peace externally cannot be sustained for very long. So renunciation is also an opulence in terms that it grants us peace. So these are the various opulences, and whatever different people are attracted to in this world, actually they can be subdivided into these six categories. Now Krishna, it is described in the scriptures, possesses all these opulences in full. It's not just that Krishna possesses these opulences more than others. In this world, there might be one person who is wealthier than other persons. So, that person is the number one wealthy person. But Krishna is not just the number one wealthy person, he's the only wealthy person. You know, whatever wealth everyone else has, that actually belongs to Krishna only. It's temporarily in the possession of other people. So, Krishna possesses all beauty. Whatever beauty people have, that is temporarily there with those people based on their past karma and the reactions of that karma. However, with Krishna, all beauty is eternal. So in this way, Krishna possesses all these opulences in full. We will look at these opulences one by one. So let's start with K. I'm going to look at the acronym Krishna, K-R-I-S-H-N-A. So K is knowledge. Now, God is omniscient. So, omniscient means he knows everything. And Krishna makes a direct statement to that effect also in 7.25 in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, Vedaham samatitani vartamanani cha arjuna bhavishyani cha bhutani mam tu vedana kashchana. He says, I know everything, past, present and future. But me, no one knows. Mam tu vedana kashchana. So, he knows everyone, but no one actually knows him. Very few people know him, and even the devotees, they don't know him fully. So what does it mean when we say Krishna knows everything? In today's times, if somebody has a lot of general knowledge, people get impressed with all these quizzes that are there. You know, the quizzes like, say, there's Kaun Banega Karodpati or whatever, they are all based on information about trivials. Say, how much person? Oh, this film actress, how many daughters does she have? Or all kinds of questions people ask. And somebody who can give these kind of answers, who has knowledge, that person leaves everybody else wide-eyed and open-mouthed. How much knowledge he has. So, knowledge is an opulence that attracts people. Krishna knows everything about everyone at all times. So this is the meaning of God. Now, he is present in the hearts of all of us. And because he's in the heart, he has the most strategically advantageous viewpoint. He sees everything about everyone. Sometimes some magazines have this inside story. They say, other people don't know it. We are going to offer you the inside story. What actually happened? Krishna knows the inside story of everyone. Because he is inside everyone. He knows the inside story of everyone. But although Krishna is omniscient, Krishna does not use his omniscience to catch others. Krishna's omniscience, he uses it to coach others. Not to catch others, but to coach others. Catch others means, you did that wrong, you did that wrong, you did that wrong. So, when somebody does like that, always catching, you did that wrong. Then what happens is, such a person becomes overbearing, domineering. And people will develop a persecution complex. Oh, somebody will catch me, somebody will catch me. So Krishna is not a fault-finding God. Krishna knows that all of us have faults. But Krishna doesn't focus on our faults. He focuses on our potential. And he uses omniscience to help us bring out our latent spiritual potential. So Krishna, if we see, for example, let's look at Krishna's omniscience in one particular pastime. If we look at the Govardhan Leela. Now, if we consider God knows everything, then he knows everything that is going to happen in the future also. So every pastime also he knows. So if he knows the pastime, then what is the fun in it? Now suppose many times if somebody has watched a new movie or read a new novel and they say, hey, this is such a good novel or a good movie, I want to tell you the story. Another person who wants to read it, don't tell me the story now. Otherwise the fun will be spoiled. So the idea is that if we know something, then we want to share that knowledge. And others, they want to discover that knowledge for themselves. Because in the process of discovery, there is some excitement. There is some suspense and some fulfillment. So now if God knows everything, then what is the excitement? If he knows everything about everyone, then where is the excitement left? Actually, Krishna knows everything. But, as I said, now how Krishna acts with conditioned souls and how Krishna acts with liberated souls. With the conditioned souls, although Krishna knows everything, he doesn't focus on everything. He focuses on our potential, not on our faults. He knows our faults, but he doesn't focus on them. Animisho, Nimisha, Swagri, Vachaspati Rudaridhi. In the Vishnu Sahasranam, among the various names of Vishnu that are described, there are two names which are oxymoronic. Oxymoronic means they are contradictory names which are placed next to each other. So oxymoron means if somebody says, that person is a courageous coward. How can somebody be courageous and cowardly? That person is a intelligent fool. So it doesn't make sense. So this is called an oxymoron. It's a literary device which is in English. So here we have an oxymoronic glorification of the Lord. Animisho Nimisha Swagri. Animisha, Nimisha means to blink one's eyes. So Animisha means one who never blinks his eyes. Unblinkingly watches everything. And Nimisha is one who blinks his eyes. So it's described the Lord is one who never blinks his eyes and the Lord is one who blinks his eyes. So what does this mean? So one of the great acharyas in our sampradaya, Baladeva Vidyabhushan, has written a sub-commentary on the Vishnu Sahasranam. So a commentary is called as a bhashya, a sub-commentary is called as a tikka. So Baladeva Vidyabhushan has written a sub-commentary and he gives an explanation of the various names. So he says, what does this Animisha and Nimisha mean? Animisha means one who never blinks his eyes. So he says, when a devotee renders service to Krishna, Krishna unblinkingly takes note of even the smallest service that is being performed. Even the smallest service, the Lord never forgets, never neglects, never overlooks. Even the smallest service that is done by anyone. So we know the squirrel, when it was taking some little dust particle to make the bridge for Lord Ram. From the practical point of view, the contribution was insignificant. But from Krishna's point of view, it was significant. Krishna noted it. Lord Ram noted it. And not only did he note it, he pointed it out to Hanuman. He said, Hanumanji, actually, you shouldn't think that what she is doing is insignificant. So, the Lord notes. We know the famous pastime when Krishna was with Arjuna, and at that time, they were together, and then Draupadi came along. And Draupadi had brought some fruits for Krishna. So, Krishna and Arjuna were talking intimately, so Draupadi started leaving. So, at that time, Krishna took the fruits and started peeling. When he was peeling, suddenly the knife slipped from his hand, and some blood came out. So, now, Krishna's body is transcendental. But Krishna is not interested in proving to everyone, my body is transcendental. Krishna is interested in reciprocating love with his devotees. So, by his inner potency, by his yoga maya, he arranges things in such a way that the maximum devotional emotions come out. So, when the blood comes out, Draupadi became alarmed. She looked around and she just ripped off a part of her silk sari and started bandaging Krishna's finger. And Krishna told her, "Oh Draupadi, I'll remember what you have done. And I will repay you for this." And when did Krishna repay? In the Asat Sabhaya, when she was being dishonored and disrobed, Krishna rewarded by giving an unlimited sari. So, Nimesha. So, Krishna uses omniscience to note every single service that a devotee does. And Nimesha. Nimesha means one who blinks his eyes. So, Baldevi Devotion explains that if a devotee commits a mistake, then the Lord blinks his eyes and overlooks the mistake. So he overlooks the mistake. So the example for this is Putana. When Putana came, she had a murderous intention, although she had a motherly demeanor. She acted like a mother, but internally her intention was to kill Krishna. So what did Krishna do? Krishna closed his eyes. Krishna did not focus on her evil intention. He focused just on her benevolent maternal expression. Yes, she wants to serve me. Krishna saw that little good and highlighted that and granted her a position as a nurse in the spiritual world. So, Krishna uses omniscience to magnify the good qualities of others and to minimize their faults. So, Animesha Animesha means he magnifies the good in others and he minimizes the faults. So, this is Krishna's omniscience. He knows everything about everyone. But he is not interested in proving to everyone that I know everything. When Krishna performs pastimes, his goal is not to prove his position. His goal is to improve others' disposition. What is Krishna's goal? It is not to prove his position. Not that I am God and I'll prove it to you. No, that is not Krishna's concern. On certain occasions, like Krishna made a display the Virat Rupa to either Arjuna or to Yashoda Mai or to Duryodhana, that time he is proving his position. But when Krishna acts, his primary goal is to improve others' disposition. Improve others' disposition means that he wants to change others' mentality, to get them to become attracted to him. And that's why he will do whatever is required for them. So, now, we know the pastime when Durvasa Muni was manipulated by Duryodhana to go to the forest and to receive hospitality from the Pandavas. And Duryodhana told him, go in the afternoon. And he knew if they go in the afternoon, Draupadi will have already eaten. And they had that Akshay Patra, which was Akshaya, which was imperishable, inexhaustible, as long as Draupadi had not eaten. So Duryodhana wanted to get Draupadi into trouble. So the Pandavas into trouble, not just Draupadi. So then when Durvasa Muni went there, so he came and Yudhishthira Maharaj, on one side he was ambivalent. He was happy to see a sage coming, but he was thinking, how will I serve him? And he asked Draupadi, can you do something? So Draupadi was also panic struck. But then she said, let me pray to Krishna. And when Krishna came along, what did Krishna do? Krishna said, Draupadi was in anxiety and Krishna said, Draupadi, I am very hungry. Can you give me something? So, you can imagine the plight of Draupadi's heart. First of all, she has asked the Lord to come and help. I am in trouble and the Lord makes a request which will put her in greater trouble. Just to not be able to satisfy a guest is a bad thing, but to not be able to satisfy the Lord is even worse. But, now why did the Lord make such a request? The Lord is omniscient. And the Lord knows that He Himself is present as a super soul in the heart of Draupadi. And He arranged that that day, when Draupadi washed the Akshay Patra, she left a little grain over there. Normally she was meticulous in washing. But Krishna arranged it in such a way that that day when she washed the Akshay Patra, a little morsel remained. And Krishna used His omniscience for that purpose. Draupadi, just go and look, Draupadi. See what is, if something is there. He said, oh, there is only one morsel. Now Draupadi was surprised. So Draupadi was a meticulous housewife. In fact, she was such a diligent servant that even Rukmini, the goddess of fortune, the consort of Krishna, she came and took advice about how to serve the Lord, how to serve her husbands. And how could Draupadi have been unclean? She was not unclean. The Lord arranged the whole pastime. So the Lord uses His omniscience to deliver His devotees from trouble. So even a devotee's apparent mistake can be used by the Lord for advancing His own plan. This is Krishna's omniscience. So Krishna uses His omniscience for delivering His devotees, for enabling them to come closer to Him. So now what did He do? Through this whole pastime, He baffled Duryodhana. And He ensured that the Pandavas were protected. And for all time to come, He demonstrated how He is the protector of His devotees. And this way, He uses His actions and His opulences to improve others' dispositions, to get them to become attracted to Him, to give up their aversion to Him. And when Krishna performs pastimes, His focus is not on knowing. As I was telling earlier, when Krishna is acting with the conditioned souls, He's doing it to improve their disposition. And when He's performing His pastimes with the liberated souls, they don't need to improve their disposition. They already know everything. They already know everything means they know Krishna and they love Krishna. So there, Krishna uses His omniscience or conceals His omniscience, whatever is best, for intensifying the emotion. For intensifying the emotion. So when Krishna performs pastimes, He normally acts as if He's just a small child who doesn't know anything. And He's just playing around, running around. And when He's running around, He acts as if He's just a mischievous little child when He's in Vrindavan. And when He's acting as if He's just a mischievous little child, so when Putana came, continuing the same pastime, when Putana came, Krishna knew that Putana is this ferocious demon. And Krishna actually sucked out her life air at that time itself. But then Krishna could have made her drop dead at that time itself. But what did Krishna do? Krishna wanted to intensify the emotion of the Rajavasis. So He used His omniscience so that Putana, she, Muncha, Muncha, let me go. And she just ran out of Vrindavan. Krishna did not want the scenic atmosphere of Vrindavan to be disrupted. So He held on to her breast, but He did not suck out her life. He let her go out of Vrindavan, and then He let her fall outside Vrindavan. So whatever devastation is outside Vrindavan. And not only that, so Krishna arranged in such a way that He is present as a super soul in the heart also. So when Putana went, she went northwards, and there was a big orchard, fruit grow of Kamsa. And that was what was destroyed. So Putana went and fell on that. So Krishna uses His omniscience for what purpose? So for defying His opponents and for intensifying the emotion of His devotees. So the Vrajavasis, suddenly they heard this blood-curdling scream of Putana. And suddenly, there Krishna was there one moment, and this Putana was so beautifully, having such a beautiful appearance initially. And suddenly she became this hideous witch and was screaming and running away. All the Prajavasis were horrified. So they experienced the Bibhatsa Rasa. There are different rasas, and all these rasas intensify the reciprocation of love between Krishna and His devotees. So Bibhatsa, Bhayanaka, horror, fear, these rasas, the Vrajavasis experience. And then later on, when they ran out and they saw, where is Krishna? They saw this giant body of Putana, but then Krishna was just a small baby playing on her chest. So Krishna uses his omniscience in the pastimes to intensify the emotional reciprocations between him and his devotees. So Krishna did not tell. Krishna remained as a small baby. He did not tell them, oh, this was a demoness, she came to kill me and I killed her. Krishna, he uses his knowledge. This is Putana, she needs to be killed. But then after that, he acts as if he's a small baby who doesn't know anything. So Krishna uses his opulence to intensify the reciprocation of love. And one way he does that is, sometimes he makes it appear as if his devotees know more than him. That his devotees have greater knowledge than him. And that is demonstrated in the pastime of Bhishma Pitamaha. Bhishma Pitamaha, when Yudhishthira Maharaj was bewildered about what I should do, after the war got over, he considered himself responsible for having caused the bloodshed of the death of so many people. So then, all the great sages there tried to console him, tried to help him see, understand, but he could not. Even Krishna could not. And what did Krishna say? Let us go to Bhishma Pitama. And Bhishma Pitama spoke. And Krishna empowered Bhishma Pitama. Actually, when the pastime, only its concluding part is described in the Bhagavatam, in the 9th chapter in the first canto. But in the Bhishma Parva in the Mahabharata, and then afterwards, Bhishma Parva is one of the longest Parvas, and after that Shanti Parva and Anushasan Parva, where Bhishma Pitama instructs Yudhishthira Maharaj, one of the longest sections of the Mahabharata. So, therein, Bhishma Pitama expounds elaborately, and the Lord gives him a blessing. So when Krishna and Yudhishthira and all of them come in front of Bhishma Pitama, and Krishna tells Yudhishthira, please instruct Yudhishthira. Bhishma says, you know, Bhishma gives three reasons why I cannot instruct. He says, actually I am very weak and sick. I may die at any moment. And he says that my intelligence is not at all clear. And he says that I am the student and you are the teacher of the world. How can the student speak in front of the teacher, in the presence of the teacher? So Krishna says that actually I will give a blessing. By my mystical power, you will actually have whatever strength is necessary for you to speak. And your intelligence will be as clear as if you are in fresh youth. And then Krishna turns it around. He says, actually, you are the venerable grandsire. And all of us should hear from you. When you will depart from the world, a great treasury of wisdom will depart. We are all eager to hear from you. And then he says, if you think that I am the teacher and you are the student, then how can the student refuse the instruction of the teacher? So please speak. Now Bhishma Pitama is left with no alternative. And then Bhishma speaks. So Krishna uses his omniscience. He grants devotees knowledge so that they can expound. They can expand and expound both. Expound means explain. Expand means elaborate further. So this is how Krishna shares his opulence of omniscience with everyone. R is renunciation. K-R-I-S-H-N. R is renunciation. So now, Krishna, how is he renounced? Actually, when Krishna performs pastimes, you know, Prabhupada often, when people would challenge Krishna, any of the Krishna conscious principles, Prabhupada would rarely go on the defensive. Prabhupada would be on the offensive. So, that means one Christian priest came and asked Prabhupada, you know, how do you worship Krishna as God? So, he says, you know, he was so lusty. He had so many queens. So, Prabhupada said, what is your definition of God? He says, God? God is the greatest. Yes, so if God is the greatest, if God is unlimited, then God should be unlimitedly lusty. So he was shocked. He could just digest the whole idea. So, Prabhupada said that, why 16,000? No, God should have unlimited queens, unlimited wives. So, that is what he just couldn't digest the whole idea. Prabhupada said that, actually, when Krishna performs pastimes, he is simply reciprocating love with his devotees. And he reciprocates love in such a way that he satisfies everyone. So we have rules of morality. Nowadays we have monogamy, one husband, one wife. We have rules of morality, this is important. But Krishna, He is not immoral, he is transmoral. See, there is moral level, there is below morality is a morality. Above morality is transmorality. It's transcendental morality. See, we need morality because otherwise our own selfish desires will make us exploitative and manipulative. But Krishna has no selfish desires. Krishna is motivated simply by pure love. And he acts for increasing the happiness of his devotees and thereby relishing happiness himself. So, if we look at Krishna having so many consorts, queens in Vrindavan or gopis in queens in Dwarka or gopis in Vrindavan, we may see how is he renounced. But actually, although Krishna has so many queens, Krishna is not attached to anyone. He is spiritually concerned about others. We could say even spiritually attached, but he is Atmaram. He is self-satisfied. Because he is self-satisfied, he doesn't need anyone. And this is demonstrated in the Ras Leela. The Ras Panchadhyaya comes from chapters 29 to 33 in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in that, first Krishna calls all the gopis and the gopis come. And then Krishna, when he sees that the gopis, he leaves the gopis. So this is described in the 10th canto. And Kavi Karunapur, in his book Anand Vrindavan Champu, elaborates this. And he describes what actually happened. So when Krishna talked with the gopis and they were about to start performing the rasa dance, at that time, the gopis, they started thinking, oh, we are so fortunate. Among all the women in the world, Krishna has chosen to dance with us. He's chosen to perform Ras Leela with us. So, Krishna, now there is an external understanding of this pastime and there is an internal understanding of this pastime. So the external understanding is that Krishna saw that the gopis became proud and he did not like pride in his devotees, so he left them. And now, the actual inner understanding is Krishna, he loves all his devotees, he loves all the gopis. But he wanted to glorify Radharani. Among all these gopis, there is one gopi whose love is supremely special for me. And that's why Krishna left all the gopis to be with Radharani alone. So when Krishna is there in the forest with all these beautiful women, Prabhupada explains that Krishna is leaving all of them. This exhibits Krishna's opulence of renunciation. Krishna left all of them because he was more concerned about their heart than about his own pleasure. He did not want his devotees to become proud. So that's why he left them at that particular time, so that their love would become more intense and more pure. So Krishna exhibits renunciation over there. Now as Krishna and Radharani were going along, they went deep into the forest and other gopis were frantically searching. And Radharani realized that she is with Krishna, Krishna is with her alone. Her heart swelled with joy. See how much Krishna loves her. But then immediately a contrary emotion started rushing through her heart. He said, how can I be enjoying Krishna's company alone? Now all my sakhis, Lalita, Vishakha, all of them, they love me so much. They love me more than their life. So what will be their condition now when Krishna has left them? They will be heartbroken. And if they are heartbroken, how can I enjoy at that time? So Radharani thought like this. And she was torn. She had her devotion to Krishna, but she also had her affection for her sakhis. And then she decided that all the sakhis will be searching for her. So she decided that, let me slow Krishna down. So if all the sakhis are searching for us, if we slow down, Krishna was going deep into the forest rapidly. So if we slow down, then the other sakhis will catch up. And then we can all enjoy Krishna's association. So when she thought like this, she was thinking how to tell Krishna. She said, see, Krishna, you know, we have been performing pastimes for so long. I am feeling tired now. So Krishna still wanted to go deeper inside the forest. Krishna. Then Radharani said, oh, no, I cannot go deeper inside. I am very tired. So then Krishna understood Radharani's heart. But at the same time, he, at an external level, wanted to demonstrate something, you see. Then he apparently became angry. And he said that, because this is a forest and not a kingdom, I cannot get a palanquin for you. So, if you want to go further inside, sit on my shoulders. And as he spoke like this, Radharani was agonized to hear his harsh tone. And as he spoke like this, suddenly he disappeared from there. And when he disappeared, Radharani's agony multiplied millions of times over. And she started looking, where is Krishna? Krishna, I have angered Krishna. Her intention was not at all to anger Krishna. Her intention was only concern for her fellow sakis. But when she saw that Krishna had become angered and Krishna had left her, and she was utterly alone. Kavi Karnapur describes that Radharani's intensity of agony was greater than the intensity of the agony of all the other sakis at that time also. Because all the other sakis, they had each other. So they were discussing Krishna's pastimes, they were reminding each other, consoling each other, encouraging each other, and they were searching for Krishna. But Radharani was utterly alone. Nobody. Now in this world, if people reject us, it is painful. If the whole world rejects us, it is even more painful. But if the Lord rejects us, what will we do? So Radharani was utterly alone. She had left everyone when she came out in the forest to perform Ras Leela. Pati sutanvaya bhratru bandhavan ati vilangyate antyachyutagatah. So they gave up all their relatives. Their brothers, their parents, they're all relatives. Bhratru bandhava ati vilangyate. We gave up all our relatives and we came despite. So she had already left the world. She was in the association of devotees. But then she had left the devotees also. She was all alone with the Lord, and the Lord also left her. So she was completely alone. So here, Radharani exhibits her renunciation. Now she could have been enjoying Krishna's association, but what was she doing? She was concerned about other devotees. She was concerned about her sakis. And Krishna understood her heart. But Krishna wanted to demonstrate that if anything at an external level, it seemed as if it was pride. But it was not pride. At external level we can learn a lesson, but inner level, Krishna wanted to demonstrate to all the gopis, including Radharani, and to the world through their example, the glory of their love. So when the gopis were separated from Krishna in this way, then the intensity of their remembrance became much, much, much more. So actually, for love is like fire. And separation is like the wind. So, when there is wind, imagine the house is on fire and a big wind comes along. What happens? The fire goes out to another house. The fire spreads. So like that, when there is love and there is separation, the wind of separation causes the fire of love to grow greater and greater. Of course, we should not think I'll become separated from devotees. Then my bhakti will grow. Now, this will happen only if that fire is big. If the fire is small and a wind comes along, you'll get extinguished. So, like that, for us, if we go away from devotee association, think separation. Oh, separation will lead to extinction. Now our bhakti will just get extinguished. So, we have to stay in the association of devotees. But when the love is so high that no question of it being extinguished, then separation increases the love just as wind spreads the fire. So Krishna intensified the love of the gopis by becoming separated from them. And then later on he became reunited with them. There is the whole 31st chapter of the 10th canto where the gopis sing the song, Gopi Gita. Very beautiful prayers. And then Krishna reappears and then they have a discussion in that 32nd chapter. And 33rd chapter is they perform the rasa dance. So here we see that the Lord and his devotees, what is their renunciation? That although they can have all the pleasure they want, they are concerned about others. They are concerned about others. Rather than enjoying for themselves, they are concerned about others. Now Krishna can happily be there in the spiritual world, performing pastimes with his devotees. Why does he have to come to the material world at all? Now he is performing pastimes with his devotees in the spiritual world. The souls who have rejected him, he can also reject them. You say goodbye to me, I say goodbye to you. Fine. Relationship over. Krishna doesn't do that. He comes again and again to this material world. Sambhavami yuge yuge. He comes again and again. 4.8 Bhagavad Gita says that. Why does he come again and again? Because his love for us is unending. His compassion for us is unceasing. And because of that, he never tires. He keeps coming. So his renunciation is manifested in his being not concerned about his own pleasure, but his putting the pleasure of his devotees above his own pleasure and putting the well-being of the conditioned souls also above his own pleasure. Of course, Krishna doesn't become miserable when he comes to this world. He is happy here also. He performs his pastimes here also. But still his coming here itself is an exhibition of renunciation. You know, if we are loved and cherished in a particular place, and then we are told, you go to some other place where people either neglect you or reject you or hate you, we would want to go to such a place. So Krishna is loved and cherished in the spiritual world, and nobody cares for him practically in the material world. Why does he have to come from the spiritual world to the material world? Although nobody cares for him, he cares for everybody. And that is why he comes to this world. So that itself is a manifestation of his renunciation. So I is influence. So influence is related with fame. The greater the fame of a person, the greater is the influence. Now, if some person is a famous politician or a famous sports star, a famous movie star, then what happens? Doors open for that person. And whatever that person wants, people go out of their way to do that for the person. So if it's a famous movie star or a famous politician, somebody comes along, and then that person doesn't have to stand in the queue. Oh, you can go ahead, please. It's an honor that you have come. So like that, fame brings influence. Now, Krishna has the supreme fame. What does it mean that he has the supreme fame? We may say that, before Srila Prabhupada went to the West, people did not know about Krishna, so many people all over the world. Then, how can we say that Krishna has the supreme fame? When we talk about the opulence of fame, we have to understand that opulence has to be understood in its context. See, even if a person is a big millionaire, or maybe the person is the world's biggest trillionaire, whatever, quadrillionaire or whatever is the highest. So, the wealthiest person in the world. Now, if there is a cockroach in his house, does the cockroach understand his wealth? The cockroach will just be looking, where is garbage that I can eat? Isn't it? So, when we talk about now that person, maybe there on the cover page of Forbes magazine and Newsweek magazine and this magazine and that magazine, and even if the cockroach comes, the cockroach will not see that magazine, he will want to eat the cover, that's all. So when we want to talk about fame, there has to be a certain level of education to understand the concept of fame also. So without that basic level of consciousness, even when a person has fame, others will not understand it. So similarly, Krishna's fame is sung by all the seers and knowers in the world, in the universe. Now those people who know, they sing his glories. And not just in this universe, in all universes. There are innumerable universes, and wherever they are, people are glorifying him. In the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, there is a description of the cosmology. And there it is described how in all the lokas, wherever people may be, they are all glorifying the Supreme Lord. So the whole focus of the fifth canto's description is, show how there is Kim Purusha loka here, there is this loka here, there is that loka there. But wherever there are people are glorifying the different manifestations of the Supreme Lord. So from that transcosmic perspective, cosmic means universal, transcosmic means many, many universes. From that transcosmic perspective, Krishna is supremely famous. So within the vast scale of universal time, Kali Yuga is like a dark splotch. Kali Yuga is a time of ignorance. And from the vast time scales, Kali Yuga is so tiny. So in this tiny splotch, within the vastness of cosmic time, if some people don't know about Krishna, that is not Krishna's loss. That is the loss of those people. So, actually, even on earth, and even in Kali Yuga, before a few thousand years ago, when Vedic culture was there all over the world, people knew about Krishna. So, this is the effect of Kali Yuga, that which is known to everyone everywhere, that people become blind to it. That is the nature of Kali Yuga. But Krishna's fame is such that people all over all the universes, and beyond all the universes to the spiritual world, they are all glorifying Krishna. And even now, if we see, people may not know specifically about Krishna, but they do know about God. And there are people all over the world who do worship God. They may have their own conception of God. But Krishna is God ultimately. So, Krishna's fame is available to people, is spread throughout the world through the general knowledge about God also. Now when Krishna, we say Krishna is all famous. The most beautiful aspect of Krishna's glory is that Krishna does not delight in his fame. You know, when people are famous, they actually feel very irritated when somebody doesn't acknowledge their fame. You know, somebody comes to, if a very famous movie star comes along and nobody turns a head to look at him also. What is this? You know, are these people ignorant? Do they not know my glories? So, now sometimes when they want their privacy, they may say, oh, the press is always hounding us and this is that problem, we want to be alone. But that is one when they want their privacy. But normally, they want their fame to be known to everyone. But Krishna is such that, although he is supremely famous, he doesn't delight in his fame. In the spiritual world, what does he do? Actually, he covers his fame. So the Vrajavasis don't think of Krishna as God. They think of Krishna as just our heartthrob, our sweet Krishna. They think of him as the most attractive, the most lovable member of their community. And Krishna never frees them from that illusion. Now, that is actually a divine illusion. That is an illusion which intensifies the bhakti. So, Krishna, when he is in Vrindavan, what does he do? He does not delight in the majesty of his godhood. He delights in the intimacy of love. And that's why he conceals his fame. And he's famous in Vrindavan, but he's famous not as God. He's famous as our most lovable little Krishna. That's what they think of. And that's how Krishna loves it. And what does Krishna do with fame? He wants his devotees to be more famous than himself. And that's why we see that Krishna made Yudhishthir Maharaj the king of the world. He did not himself become the king of the world. Yudhishthira pratishthata varhibharavatamsaka. So, it is described in the Krishna Ashtotar Shatanama, which is in the Brahmanda Purana, that actually, a king is meant to wear a crown. So what is the crown that Krishna wore? Krishna varhibharavatamsaka. He wore a crown of a peacock feather. But what did he do for his devotee? Yudhishthira pratishthata. He offered Yudhishthir Maharaj the crown of the whole world. Now why did he do that? Because he loves to see his devotees glorified. He wants his devotees to become more and more famous. So the fame is an opulence which Krishna wants his devotees to enjoy. And in this way, Krishna expands the sweetness of love. God is supreme. But his supremacy is manifested by his giving glory to his devotees. So Yudhishthir Maharaj, when he became the king, what did he do? There is the sweetness of reciprocation. That Yudhishthir Maharaj was anointed as the emperor of the world and then he performed the Rajasuya sacrifice. And then what did he do over there? He performed the Agra Puja where Krishna was glorified as the supremely worshipable personality in the assembly over there. So the devotee wants to glorify Krishna. Krishna wants to glorify the devotee. Unfortunately, what we want to do is we want to glorify ourselves and we want others to glorify us also. So when we want fame for ourselves, then we can't get prema for ourselves. When we want fame, then our heart is so filled with ourselves. My greatness. Now actually, when we want to broadcast our own glories, there are two problems with it. The first problem is we don't have too many glories. We think that I have, but actually how many? We have some fame, some qualities, but we don't have too many glories. And second problem is that our glories can go away at any time. I may think that I am a very great speaker and suddenly I forget something. What happens to my ego? It just gets shattered. My fame, it gets shattered. Now Krishna demonstrates this. When he wants to glorify his devotees, he glorifies his devotees in extraordinary ways. But when he wants to teach, he uses his devotees also in extraordinary ways. You know, Arjuna, he was famous as the world's greatest archer. and he had defeated everyone in the forest, in the Kurukshetra war. But then some infidel cowherds, you know, Arjuna couldn't fight with them. So Krishna wants to demonstrate that whatever glory we have, that is not ours, it can go away. So when we try to delight in our own fame, then we open ourselves to insecurity and misery. Insecurity because our glory is never enough and it may go away at any time. When it goes away, we'll become miserable. So instead of that, if we choose to delight in Krishna's glories, in making Krishna famous, then what happens by that?
Tvadviryagayam mahamritamagna chittaha shochetato vimukhachetasa indriyarthan maya sukhaya bharamidvahato vimudhan.
So Prahlad Maharaj prays that, my dear Lord, when I glorify you, tvad virya gayan, when I glorify you, what do I experience? Mahamrita magna chittaha. What I experience is a mahamrita, the supreme nectar. And my consciousness, magna chittaha. It has become completely absorbed in that. It's lost in that. And normally in this world, when we are trying to practice Krishna consciousness, our mind always keeps telling, you are missing that pleasure, you are missing that pleasure, you are missing this, you are missing that. So we come to the temple for a satsang program, we think, oh, today, what was the movie on the television today? I am missing that movie. So, like that, the mind always keeps telling us, you are missing this, you are missing that. So, because of that, we are not able to put our heart in Krishna consciousness. But Prahlad Maharaj says that actually when I start glorifying you wholeheartedly, I get so much nectar that instead of feeling that I am missing something, I start feeling that everyone else is missing this. Why don't everyone come and take this? Shochetato vimukhachetasa indriyarthan. I am glorifying you, I am getting mahamrita, and I am simply lamenting, oh, all the other souls, they have turned away from you, so they are not getting anything. They have become vimukha and they are shoche, they are lamenting. Let me give this to them also. So, this is the reciprocation of love. Krishna is supremely famous, and when a devotee chooses to glorify him, the devotee gets mahamrita, the supreme nectar. So this is influence. S, K-R-I-S-H-N-A, S is strength. So Krishna is supremely strong. His strength is not just in terms of physical prowess. When Krishna wants, he can manifest the supreme level of physical prowess. When Krishna wants, he can just lift the whole Govardhan Hill. And he can just lift the Govardhan Hill, and then he lifts it. Actually, when he lifts it also, Indra is considered in the Vedic text to be extremely powerful. So, Indra is an extremely powerful god, and Indra's prowess is that when he throws a thunderbolt, he can cause even a mountain to crush to powder. So, Krishna used the most insignificant part of his body. You know, sometimes if you want to deride somebody, like say, there is a cricket match between India and West Indies. So, India says West Indies is not a very good team now. So, we'll send an India A team over there. So, what is the idea? The idea is that we don't consider you to be even our equal. So, we'll send a second grade team to you. So like that, if you want to minimize somebody's strength, we'll say, "Tu to mere baaye haath ka khel hai." You know, I'll just dismiss you with my left hand. So what did Krishna tell show Indra? "Tu to mere baaye haath ke chote ungli ke naakhun ka khel hai." So, just with the ek din maan Indra kumaro, nakha upar govardhan dharo. So when Krishna wants, he can exhibit such strength that everybody else's strength becomes reduced not just to insignificance but even to non-existence. It is just, Indra said, what is this? How is it possible? How could this Indra, when he first saw this, he sent his messengers to, what is happening over there? He says, the whole of Vrindavan has been destroyed. I said, very good news. Just go and double check it once. Because this Krishna is a little wily, we have to see. And then he said, actually, No, nothing is destroyed. They are all happily enjoying under Govardhan. So, the messenger was so shocked to see this. He just ran back. He said, under Govardhan? How is Govardhan not falling? He said that in the bygone ages, mountains had wings. So, I cut off their wings. So, how did Govardhan suddenly develop wings? So, he said, no, go and check. He said, Govardhan doesn't have any wings. Then,
He says, Krishna has lifted all of Govardhan. He says, really, that 8-year-old, how could he have lifted such a big hill? So now Krishna, he has the supreme opulence and he exhibits his strength when he wants to. When he wants to. So now some skeptic may ask, you know, how can somebody lift up such a big thing? Even if Krishna has to lift it, if you go from a scientific perspective, you'll have to find the center of gravity first. And then balance everything with the exact center of gravity. So how did Krishna find the center of gravity of Govardhan? Now Krishna doesn't have to find the center of gravity because he is the source of gravity. So, when he wants, the law of gravity will act. When he doesn't want, the law of gravity will stop. So, he will suspend the law of gravity when he wants it. So, Krishna exhibits such extraordinary opulence when he wants to. And he exhibited this opulence in the wrestling match at Mathura. When he was in Mathura, he just fought and effortlessly, he just defeated and destroyed and delivered the wrestlers who were at that time world champions. You know, Kamsa, he was the autocratic ruler. And you know, when somebody is power hungry, that person wants the best power to be with himself. So Kamsa had got the best wrestlers in the world to be with him. But Krishna just effortlessly destroyed all of them. And he defeated, there was a wrestling match, arena was there. And he fought and defeated all of them. And then after that, and Krishna invited all his Gopa friends to come on that assembly. And he said, let us wrestle. And when they were dancing and wrestling, and they wrestled several times, and each time the Gopas defeated Krishna. And Kamsa just got intellectually short-circuited. Just couldn't understand this. How? He said, my wrestlers, nobody could defeat them, and just Krishna defeated them. And now, these Gopas, nobody knows them also. And they are defeating Krishna. So, Kamsa decided, this is too much. And he just decided, arrest. He says, arrest Nanda Maharaj. Plunder their wealth. Kill Krishna. And then Krishna decided, this is enough now. And then when he wanted to exhibit his strength, you know, normally, if we have a match, you know, the spectators are at a slightly higher height, they can watch the match. So like that, now, Kamsa was the chief spectator. So he was the king, so he was at a big height. And the wrestling match was going on the ground. But Krishna, so Kamsa was thinking, I will kill Krishna. He was just swinging his sword around. You know, sometimes when somebody wants, a bowler wants to bowl. So you know, you just go through the follow through first. Go to action so that after the real fight will start. But as Kamsa was doing like this, moving around his sword. So Krishna, with blinding speed, he was right down, he just jumped up. And before Kamsa knew what hit him, Krishna just caught him, knocked off his sword, knocked off his shield, and started swinging him around. And just by that swinging around, Kamsa died. And then just to demonstrate and the destruction of Kamsa, and to reassure his parents, Krishna threw him down from the top and dragged him along the ground. So when Krishna wants, he can exhibit extraordinary strength. Now, when Krishna was wrestling with his Gopas in between, it was not that Krishna was, you know, deliberately saying, hey, I want you to defeat me. Actually, Krishna wrestled in an earnest. But Krishna was defeated by his Gopas. So when Krishna wants, he can exhibit supreme strength. And when Krishna wants, he can conceal his strength. Because he is concerned with the reciprocation of love and the deliverance of others. So when Kamsa was terrorizing everyone, then, at that time, Krishna wanted to put an end to his terrorism. So now somebody may say, if Krishna had to, Krishna was going to eventually rid the world of Kamsa, then Krishna could have done that when he was a small baby only. You know, why have this whole pastime of first being born in Mathura, then go to Vrindavan, and then come back from Vrindavan, and then kill Kamsa? Krishna, he exhibits his strength according to what will lead to the maximization of the emotion, of the bhava in the devotees. So during this period when Krishna was in Vrindavan, you know, if Krishna had just killed Kamsa after he was born, he could have done that. You know, when Vamanadev appeared, Vamanadev did not appear as a baby. Vamanadev appeared as a young child and as a boy, And as a boy only, he went to Bali Maharaj and he took everything from Bali Maharaj. Krishna could have done that also. But Krishna wanted to demonstrate to the world the love of the Vrajavasis. And that's why he arranged for this intermediate period. When he came to Vrindavan and he exhibited the spiritual world, the just pure, pristine, perennial love of the spiritual world. And then during this period, the intensity of the Mathuravasis' love for Krishna and their desperate dependence on him increased further. And then Krishna came and delivered. So Krishna is all strong, but he exhibits his strength according to what is best suited for his pastimes. So sometimes he may exhibit his strength and sometimes he may not exhibit his strength. How does he choose that? Depending on what is best for the intensity of the pastime, what is the best for everyone else. So Krishna is all powerful. Prahlad Maharaj prays that Konvatrate akhila garo bhagavan prayasa uttarane yasya bhava sambhavalo paheto. So he says, my dear Lord, you are the creator, maintainer and destroyer of all the worlds. Now, what is the difficulty for you in destroying the conditions that bind the conditioned soul? The conditionings that bind the conditioned soul. He says, there is no difficulty for you. But if you want it, you can just do it in one moment. Now, whatever lust is there, greed is there, anger is there, whatever arrogance is there, all those anarthas Krishna can destroy in one moment. Then why is he not doing it? Because he wants to see the intensity of our desire. So all the endeavor that we are doing in our sadhana, through that we show Krishna the intensity of our desire. And when we show that, Krishna can in one moment just remove the anartha. So even if we feel that we are fighting, nothing is happening, but we should know that Krishna's omnipotence, his supreme strength is there with us. And with this strength, he can do magic in one moment. So because he can do magic in one moment, a devotee is always faithful. A devotee is always hopeful. Yes, patient. Even if things don't work out right now, they will work out. Krishna has some plan by which he will be doing the best for me. I don't understand it right now. But when we have faith in Krishna's strength, then a devotee can never become hopeless. As long as our faith is in our strength, then we feel, oh, I'm not strong enough. Maybe I'll just succumb. So then we will sooner or later become frustrated and hopeless. But when our faith is in Krishna's strength, then we know Krishna is supremely powerful. So we just continue on doing what we can. And Krishna's strength will do magic in our heart and magic in our life in due course of time. So this is strength. Then, I have to adjust some of the words here. So H is related with wealth. So in this word, you know, when people use the word, I have a lot of holdings. I have some property here, some property there, some property there. So H refers to holdings. So people, what do they want? They want to hold on to their wealth. Like we have the word householder. You know, so holding. So holding means to one who has wealth. So Krishna has the supreme wealth. Krishna has, actually everything everywhere belongs to Krishna. Now how can we say that, you know, my house belongs to me, that person's house belongs to that person? Yes, it does belong, but for, belong, but for how long? We may think, I own this, but suddenly, you know, some earthquake can happen in the city, or some earthquake can happen in the heart. You know, a heart attack is like an earthquake in the body. So when that happens, you know, we just go away and our property deed, then everything is left. You know, there was at one time, where the Saraswati River was, there was a huge civilization over there, that is in the Rajasthan area. But suddenly, at one particular time, because of some earthquake, the whole Saraswati River changed its track, just gone. Like we have tsunamis when earthquake comes under the ocean, so like that, earthquake sort of thing happened under the crust of the earth. And Saraswati just changed course. And that which was a flourishing hinterland, almost overnight, transformed into a desert. And this happened around the 5th century BCE. So some of the travelers who came with Alexander, when he came to conquer India, they write, for them, this is, you know, there was, we can still see, there was an opulent kingdom, there was big, big, big houses. They are there and they are opulent. But it's all in a state of ruination. So what can be a huge kingdom at one moment with thousands of people owing a huge amount of wealth? In one moment everything can be lost. So actually our property is only temporarily our property. Ultimately everything belongs to Krishna. So when everything belongs to Krishna, that doesn't mean that we have to be poverty stricken. That simply means that we don't get infatuated by our temporary possessions. We focus on our eternal position, that is our relationship with Krishna. Now when Krishna possesses everything, what does he do? See, when Krishna comes in this world, he does not, when a child is born, he is not born with a land claim. This whole world belongs to me. No, Krishna, he just performs his pastimes and in that he demonstrates his supremacy. So as the creator of the world, everything belongs to him. He has created it. He owns it. But when he performs his pastimes, he acts in such a way that he will let the wealth of the world be distributed in a way that is best for everyone. So when Krishna was living in Vrindavan, first he lived in Vrindavan, after that he went to Mathura, then he went to Dwarka. So that when he was in Dwarka, from there he was helping the Pandavas. As he was helping the Pandavas, Krishna, he could have been the ruler of the whole world. And he actually rid the world of most of the demons. But Krishna created a fabulously opulent city, Dwarka, which was disconnected from the main landmass. That's how it was protected. And there all the opulence that anybody on the earth could have had, and in fact anybody in the heavens could have had, that was there. Sudharma's assembly from heavens was brought over there. So there was extraordinary opulence that all the kings all over the world were amazed at the opulence of the Yadu assembly. That which belongs to the heavens, that is brought over here. But Vyasadeva in the Bhagavatam says that actually that is not astonishing. This is not the glory of Dwarka that Sudharma is present over there. It is the fortune of Sudharma to be present in Dwarka. Because Dwarka is higher than Swarga. Dwarka belongs to the spiritual world. And for the heavenly assembly to be present there, that is not the opulence of the Dwarka. It is the fortune of Sudharma. So Krishna, he had this tremendous opulence when he was in Dwarka. You know, he had thousands of queens, 16,108 queens, and he had a magnificent palace for each one. And not only that, he had all his relatives, they had palaces. And it is not that the remaining citizens of Dwarka were living in pigeonhole-like apartments. Now they were all living opulently. We wonder, how is this possible? So actually, Krishna does it by his mystical potency. So Krishna can expand time, Krishna can expand space. So Dwarka, in that space of Dwarka, he arranged for it to be expanded. And so that everyone could be luxuriously accommodated. But still, how does Krishna share his opulence with the world? They said, Krishna, he became the sachiva, he became the messenger, the charioteer of his devotees, of the Pandavas. And he gave the kingdom of the world to the Pandavas. And similarly, wherever we see the Lord, when the Krishna, or we see as Lord Ram, when he conquered Lanka, Lanka was extremely prosperous. But what did the Lord say? He says, let Vibhishan become the king. And he said, I want to go back to Ayodhya. He could have been in Lanka, but he was not. Why? Because he wanted Vibhishan. Vibhishan had helped him, and he wanted Vibhishan to rule the world. Similarly, when he defeated the kings at Kishkinda, Wali, he made Sugriva the king. So the Lord wants to give opulence to his devotees. And by giving opulence to his devotees, he glorifies them. So actually, the opulence of the Lord is that he not only has opulence for himself, he gives opulence to his devotees. And in Vrindavan, we see that the opulence is not in terms of material wealth. Vrindavan seems to be a very simple place, although of course, it's extremely beautiful, enchanting. But the simplicity over there is the opulence. Krishna doesn't delight in manifesting huge amount of wealth. Whenever it is required, Krishna can manifest wealth. But Krishna delights in simplicity over there. And for particular pastimes, a magnificent amount of wealth are required, unlimited amounts can be manifested. So this Krishna is not interested in just showing off the wealth. He's interested in reciprocating love. Then N is newness. Newness refers to beauty. Now Krishna is so extraordinarily beautiful that every time the devotees take darshan of him, he appears to be constantly new. Navanavarasadhamanya udditam rantumasid. That when we take darshan of Krishna, every time he appears to be new, navanavarasa. Constantly one gets new mellows in seeing his beauty. So, Krishna's beauty can be understood in various ways. One is the beauty of his form itself. His form is so attractive that throughout history poets have written many glories of his form. But when they write the glories of his form, there is a Rupa Goswami in his book Lalita Madhav says that there are two kings. They are great devotees. And they write beautiful poetry to glorify Krishna. And when Krishna comes and gives them darshan, they say, "Oh Lord, we thought we had glorified you. But now we understand that actually we insulted you. Because our glorification, it was like glorifying the emperor of the world to be the landlord of a village. And it's not a glorification, it is a minimization. So similarly, when we glorify you, we are actually, what can we talk about your glories? They're so unlimited. It's so beautiful. Still the acharyas use words, they give examples. Okay, Krishna's beauty is like his complexion like a bluish black rain cloud, freshly formed. He wears a peacock feather. He has an enchanting smile on his face. So all these descriptions they give, just give an indication. But Krishna's beauty ultimately is transcendental. So this is Krishna's beauty of his form. We are running over time, so I won't go too much into details. I'll quickly finish. So Krishna's paraphernalia is also extraordinarily beautiful. So in Jiva Goswami, Gopal Champu says that what is the beauty of Krishna's flute? He says Krishna, when he plays his flute, he releases nectar into the atmosphere. And it's a flow of nectar that floods all directions. It's a river that flows everywhere. But he says the beauty of this river is, the unique beauty of this river is, normally when a river flows, the river carries things in the direction of its flow. If a river is flowing this way, then it carries the leaves, it carries the its twigs in that direction. But he says, the beauty of Krishna's flute's nectar flow is that it moves things in the direction opposite to its flow. The further it goes, the closer it brings everyone. So like that, it attracts devotees to him. And Krishna's beauty is such that actually, once we become attracted to Krishna's beauty, we are no longer captivated by the temporarily good-looking things of this world. So, it is in the third canto, Kapila Dev, when describing the beauty of the Supreme Lord, of his own beauty, he says that actually Krishna, the Supreme Lord, has curved eyebrows. And why does he have curved eyebrows? Actually speaking, Krishna, every single attribute of his is all attractive. And the yogis, they meditate on each limb of Krishna. And that meditation captivates and purifies the heart. So his eyebrows are all attractive. And when we become attracted to the eyebrows of Krishna, then none of the beautiful features, none of the eyebrows of the people of this world, they no longer attract us. So the yogi can meditate on each limb of Krishna and get supremely attracted by that. That is Krishna's beauty. And we can get an example of the glory of Krishna's beauty through the Govardhan Leela. Now, how does Govardhan Leela demonstrate Krishna's beauty? You know, actually, the Brajavasis were beholding Krishna's beauty and that completely satisfied them. You know, people may sing songs in the movies. And you know, "Oh, you are so beautiful. I can just look at you for days and days together." But, you know, actually if you try to make people do that, they will not do that. They can't do that. So, the attraction to the beauty of the world is definitely there. But that beauty can never make us forget everything else for so long. For a few moments, for a few minutes, few hours, But after that, everything else comes up. But the Vrajvasi is, you know, for 7 days, 7 nights, no eating, no sleeping, no drinking, nothing except drinking the beauty of Krishna. And actually it was not that, now when the Vrajvasis were relishing Krishna's beauty, they had no idea. It's not like, you know, the lecture is going to end in 1.5 hours, so Govardhan Lila is going to end in 7 days. There was no schedule like that. They were just absorbed. And they were so absorbed that actually when 7 days ended, they felt, oh, it's ended so quickly. We were beholding Krishna's beauty. Actually, when the Govardhilila got over, the rain stopped, Krishna said, now you can go out. Nobody was ready to go out only. They all wanted to stay there beholding Krishna's beauty. And Krishna had to lovingly persuade them to go out. So that is Krishna's beauty. When we get to behold Krishna's beauty, then it gives us a non-material enrichment that is so fulfilling, so intoxicating, so energizing that we forget everything else. And the last is A, which is affection. You know, Krishna, his greatest opulence is not that he has all these opulences, that in spite of having all these opulences, he has an extremely affectionate nature. His Bhakta Vatsalya. Sometimes people are very famous, people are very wealthy, and then that makes them very standoffish. They don't care for anyone else. Why should I care? I have wealth. I don't need anyone. Others need me. But Krishna is so affectionate that actually he loves everyone and loves his devotee specifically. And that affection is manifested in his various pastimes, and especially in his Vrindavan pastimes. So Krishna left Vrindavan. Why did he leave Vrindavan? Because there was a conflict. The conflict was, at one level, he was demonstrating the world of love, the spiritual world in the material world, in Vrindavan. But at the same time, in this world, there was complete chaos. Now, in this world, there is the world. This is the world of law. And when there's the world, from the world of law, we can move to the world of love. So when we follow the laws of God, live according to it, then from the world of law, we can move to the world of love. But when there is no law in this world, when there is lawlessness, then people can neither live materially peacefully nor make spiritual advancement. So Krishna was in Vrindavan, he was demonstrating the world of love to everyone. At the same time, here there was the world of law, and there was complete chaos. So Krishna had to go out of Vrindavan to deliver the other people and all the conditions of all of us and to restore order in the world. So he told the Vrajvasis that I am going, but after killing all the demons, I will come back. He says, I will come back. Surely I will come back. And then Krishna was constantly thinking of Vrindavan, and that's why first he sent Uddhava. Tell the Vrajvasis that I will surely come back. Then he sent Balaramji. So Uddhava is coming. Is this Krishna leaves Vrindavan in the 40th chapter of the 10th canto. Then the 46th, 47th chapter, just 5 chapters after that, you know, Krishna sends Uddhava. And then in 65th chapter, just sometime afterwards, he sends Balaramji. And then after that, it is described that the last of the demons that Krishna killed was Dantavakra. So Shishupal, or Jarasandha, was killed by Bhima. Then Shishupal was killed in the Rajasuya sacrifice. So while the Rajasuya sacrifice was going on, at that time Shalva took that opportunity to attack Dwarka. And when Shalva was attacking Dwarka, Krishna had to return on an emergency basis to try to defend Dwarka. And when he came back, at that time, the Kauravas took that opportunity to arrange for that fixed gambling match. And they dispossessed the Pandavas of everything. So within days after the Rajasuya Yajna, just, this is how fortune swing in the world. Within days after Yudhishthira Maharaj was coronated as a conqueror of the world, and they lost everything. So later on Krishna tells Draupadi, you know, if I had been there, I would never have let the gambling match happen. But I was busy defending Dwarka against Shalva. And then, when Shalva was defeated, at that time, Shishupal and Dantavakra were very close to each other. So they had made a plan that, if you don't get to kill, I will kill. So Dantavakra said, I won't come to that assembly. I am going to perform austerities. So he went to perform austerities to please Lord Shiva. And then after that, when he came to know that Shishupal has been killed, so he became so angry, he went near Mathura. So now Mathura and Hastinapur. Hastinapur is nowadays Delhi. Mathura and Hastinapur are very close to each other. So Krishna
So he thought Krishna is still in Mathura. He's killed Shishupal and now he will come out and he will pass via Mathura towards to go back to Dwarka. So he said, there I will face him and I will kill him. But Krishna had already rushed back to Dwarka. So then Narad Muni, he saw that Dantavakra's time has come now. So he went and told Krishna that Dantavakra is waiting for you. So the Gopal Champuji Goswami describes, it was like a deer waiting for a lion to come. So then Krishna decided to go to Mathura. And in Mathura, he fought and killed Dantavakra. And he fought for some time. Dantavakra had a lot of power which he had got from Shiva. So Krishna was so eager to go to Vrindavan that he could just kill Dantavakra in one blow. But he thought, if I do that, that will be disrespect to Lord Shiva. Because Lord Shiva has given him some power. So little fight I should let him do. So that little fight. And then after that, Krishna, he killed Dantavakra. Then Dantavakra's brother was Vidurath. He came and Krishna delivered him also. And then after that, Krishna decided, now enough. He says, now I will renounce my weapons. He came to the banks of Vrindavan and a Vishram Ghat. He put aside his weapons. He said, now in this incarnation, no more weapons. I won't use any more weapons. And that's why he did not lift weapons during the Kurukshetra war. So he said, then thereafter, now I want my devotees to take the glory. So in the meanwhile, the Vrajvasis were in a constant state of anxiety. Yanda Maharaj had arranged that when Krishna was in Mathura, he would have messengers going to Mathura every day and coming back. How is Krishna? How is Krishna? How is Krishna? But when they went to Dwarka, the messengers couldn't come every day. So Krishna arranged fast horses for them. They bring regular messages. But especially when wars would break out, the Vrajvasis would have no messages. So the Vrajvasis, when Krishna would be fighting a war, they would give profuse wealth in charity and they would do austerities for the well-being and the success of Krishna. And when the battle with Shalya was going on and no news of Krishna was coming, the Vrajvasis gave away all their wealth, the last bit of wealth that they had. The only wealth that remained was when Krishna had met them in Kurukshetra, Krishna had given them some jewels. So they thought, these jewels are our last remembrance of Krishna. What Krishna has given us, we will keep them. But then eventually when they heard that Krishna is fighting with Dantavakra, at that time they give up even those jewels. He says, you know, if by giving these jewels we can have the well-being of Krishna, then let us do that. See, you know, people pray to God. The Vrajvasis pray for God. So they pray for God. You know, let God, everything be okay with God. So that is their love. Now, is it that they don't know Krishna is God? They know. But you know, their concern for him is so great that they don't think of Krishna as God. They think of Narayan as God. And they think that Narayan protect Krishna. They say, wow, although Narayan, Krishna is the source of Narayan. So then, Krishna, when he put aside his weapons, he decided to come back to Vrindavan. And he took a bath in Vishram Ghat, put aside his weapons, and came out and taking bath. Then he was flooded with memories of Vrindavan. And the Vrajvasis, they were waiting for messengers to come. So Krishna had, when he was in Dwarka, he just sent one message. The last message that he sent. Actually, he was not expecting to come immediately. But when Narad Muni sent the message that Dantavakra is there, Krishna took that opportunity to come back. So Krishna had sent a message. So the messenger came and Nanda Maharaj was there in the assembly. All the Vrajvasis were there. And then when they heard message of Krishna, everybody congregated over there. And then the messenger read out. He said, Krishna said that I am neither in Mathura nor in Dwarka. I am in this letter. Please keep this letter close to your heart and I will forever be close to your heart. And I have promised you. I have made my older brother Balramji promise that I will come back. My words may be false, but I will never let Uddhava's words be false. I will never let Balramji's words be false. Please be patient. I will soon come. And as they were reading these words out, suddenly they heard the Panchajanya being blown. And they knew, Krishna had never blown his conch shell in Vrindavan. He did not use anything opulent in Vrindavan. But the Vrajvasis knew everything about Krishna. And they knew the sound of his Panchajanya. And they erupted with thrill and joy and they ran out to the outskirts of Vrindavan. And there Krishna was seated on his chariot with Daruka riding. And they started jubilantly dancing and singing and welcoming Krishna. And as Krishna came back to Vrindavan, it was the ultimate dream of all the Vrajvasis come true.
And they all, Nanda Maharaj, Yashodamai, they embraced Krishna. And then Purnamasi was there and she said, see, I told you Krishna's coming back will be delayed, but he will surely come back. He has won the whole world and he has come back. So Nanda Maharaj said, our victory is that he won the whole world, but he left the world and came back to us. And that is Krishna's love for his devotees. Krishna did the well-being of the world, but he demonstrated that what is most supreme for him is the affection of his devotees. And it is that affection that he demonstrates in his manifestation as Krishna. So the whole pastime is very long, but there is a beautiful reunion between the Vrajavasis and Krishna. And then the Daruka is still there with his chariot. So the Vrajavasis are scared to death. One chariot took Krishna away from us. So Akrura's chariot had taken away. So they are talking with Krishna, but Nanda Maharaj's eyes are again and again going to the chariot. And then Krishna understands. He says, you know, this chariot is there to obey your commands. So this chariot will not do anything against your commands. So then Daruka sees that the Vrajavasis take such care of the chariot, such care of the horses. He thinks, this is my chariot and my horses. I have never taken such care. How great is the love of the Vrajavasis for Krishna, that anything connected with Krishna, they are taking such care of it. And then Krishna says, that now that I have become reunited with you, I will never again be separated from you. So then Krishna says that now we have demonstrated to the world, the pure world of love from the spiritual world. Now we will, what is your desire, he asks. Our desire is that we should never be separated again, and the Maharaj said. And so be it. And then Krishna, he arranges for the Aisal Daruka. Let arrange the chariot to be expanded so that everybody can be accommodated on this chariot. So all the Vrajavasis, the Gopas, the Gopis, the cows, everybody gets assembled on their chariot. The chariot expands to majestic proportions. And then they go to the banks of Yamuna at the place called Brahmarada, where Brahmarada was the place where Krishna had earlier demonstrated Brahman and the spiritual world to the Vrajavasis. And Krishna says that we will all go there. And the onlookers who were watching there, they suddenly saw this chariot moving like a blinding flash and suddenly it disappeared. So Krishna, along with the Vrajavasis, from the banks of the Yamuna, went back to the spiritual world. And as they were going back to the spiritual world, Krishna called Balramji. He called Rohini. And he called Uddhava. And he arranged for them to have expansions. So Krishna with Balramji, Rohini and Uddha, they went back to the spiritual world along with the Vrajavasis. And the remaining, their expansions, they went back to Dwarka to continue the pastimes. So in this way, Krishna honored his promise to his devotees that I will return back. He returned back and he took all of them back to the spiritual world. And for the Ayodhyavasis, this whole thing happened just in 2 months. Krishna said, I will go to kill Dantavakra. And he went to kill Dantavakra and Viduratha. And the only person who knew all that happened was Daruka. Daruka was the only person who saw the intimate love of the Vrajavasis for Krishna. And he returned back to Dwarka. And others, they went back to the spiritual world. So Krishna's affection is a supreme opulence. And among all his opulences, his affection is such that he is affectionate not just to his pure devotees. He is affectionate to all living beings. So Krishna's affection is like expanding concentric circles. His pure devotees are in the innermost circle. But everybody is in some circle surrounding Krishna. And because he loves all of us also, that's why he manifests in this world. So Janmashtami is actually a memory, is a reminder of how Krishna loves all of us. And he descends to this world to attract us back to him. So his affection is our supreme good fortune. And when we reciprocate with his affection, reciprocating with it is very easy by chanting Hare Krishna and by practicing Krishna consciousness, then Krishna manifests his beauty, his glory, his sweetness, his love, his mercy in our heart. And then he attracts us back to him. And when he attracts our heart back to him, then yam labdhva cha param labham manyate nadikam tataha yasmin stitor dukhena gurunapi na vichayate. Once we achieve that love for Krishna, there is nothing greater to be achieved. We will be supremely satisfied. And no misery will be able to trouble us. So it is this gift that Krishna comes to give.
on Bhagavad Gita, on Janmashtami. And this love for Krishna is the supreme opulence. So Krishna is supremely opulent, but his greatest opulence is his affectionate nature. And his invitation for all of us to enter into that world of love, that is what he brings to this world when he descends on Janmashtami. And that's why the Vaishnava Acharyas always pray that the only prayer we should ask from Krishna is that let our heart be attracted to him. That let our heart be attracted to him. Tvai me ananya vishaya matir madhupate sakrit ratimutvahata dadha gange vaughamudanvati. Kunti Maharani says, in she offers beautiful prayers to Krishna, 1.8.18 to 1.8.43, 26 verses. And what is the conclusion? He says the conclusion is, just as the Ganga flows towards the ocean, let my consciousness flow towards you. So Vishwanatha Chakravarti, I'll conclude with this. Vishwanatha Chakravarti says, what is the significance of Ganga flowing through, the example of Ganga flowing towards the ocean? So the Mayavadis say that they use this example of river going to the ocean for merging. They say when the river enters into the ocean, the two merge. But the devotees understand this example is not about merging, it is about meeting. You know, the river flows into the ocean, but the river never ends. The river keeps flowing towards the ocean. So like that, the devotee's heart's consciousness constantly keeps flowing towards Krishna. And Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says that a river's flow towards an ocean is characterized by two things. That nothing holds the river back and the river holds nothing back. Nothing holds the river back. That means there may be some stones, there may be some wood, there may be some logs. The river finds some way above it, below it, around it or through it. You know, some way or the other the river moves on. So nothing holds the river back. And similarly, the river holds nothing back. The river doesn't think, oh, I have to keep some water with me. Only 50% of the water let me go. Human beings may do that when they dam the river. But the river but the river doesn't do that. The river, it doesn't hold anything back. So he says, similarly, the prayer is that a devotee, nothing holds the devotee back. Whatever happens, the devotee keeps serving Krishna. Now, Prabhupada, oh, he wanted to have a business so that he could assist in his spiritual master's mission. It didn't work. His business collapsed. And what did he do? He started writing his own magazine. Nobody was taking his magazine. He started his own organization. There was a conspiracy against him. He was thrown out of the headquarters of his organization. He started helping his god brothers. His god brothers did not want his help. He started writing his own books. And people were not ready to take the books. So normally, you know, in this world, when a person has ambitions, and when a person is maybe a student college, he says, I want to become the next president of America. Then he thinks, okay, I'm an Indian, I can't become a president of America. Maybe I'll become the prime minister of India. And then as we move forward in life, you know, life gives us such reversals that the more the reversals, our ambitions start becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. Now by the time the person graduates, if I just get a job, it will be good. So, you know, if you look at Prabhupada, he was trying so many things and everything had failed, practically speaking. You know, his business had failed, his magazine project had failed, his institution project had failed, his books were not very successful, he had not made any disciples. And what did Prabhupada do? You know, his ambition, instead of becoming smaller, became bigger. He said, I want to go to America and preach. Oh, actually, people around him were stunned. He said, how will you go to America? Sumti Moraji said, Swamiji, America is so cold. You are so old. So, Prabhupada was determined. Nothing holds a devotee back. Nothing holds a devotee back. And so, a devotee holds nothing back. Now, Prabhupada offered his everything. Now, he would tirelessly share Krishna consciousness throughout the day. With all the people who came to meet him. And then, practically all night, he would share Krishna consciousness with all the people who did not come to meet him by writing his books. So, practically every drop of energy that Prabhupada had, he used that for the glorification of Krishna. And we can, in accordance to our capacity, similarly, try to follow. That let my heart's consciousness be attracted towards Krishna as a river flows towards the ocean. Yes, there are many obstacles which obstruct us. But if we persevere, if we show Krishna our diligence, our sincerity, Krishna will remove the obstacles. And our bhakti will move on unimpeded towards Krishna. So that is our hope and our prayer as Janmashtami appears. That Krishna manifests in our heart and attract us back to Him. Thank you very much. Shri Krishna Bhagavan ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Premanandi. Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama.